Good morning on this sunny, beautiful, crisp morning. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, and this is Mountain Money. Everything about money, investing, spending it, and we've got a little bit of everything this morning. And we're going to start with the author of a really interesting book. He's been on a lot of national shows lately talking about the book. His name's Matthew Hart, and the book is Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. It's everything you ever wanted to know about gold, how it comes from the ground and why it's so sought after and has been for some 6,000 years. So we're going to start off with a discussion about gold.
And Larry, I think you and I are going to have a contest to see how many different adjectives we can come up with for bitter cold. Holy cows, that was a cold weekend.
I think bitter is the most descriptive right there.
That is what I was feeling this weekend when I went out skiing. If you're a lover of electronics, which I am, as listeners know, you're going to love our second guest, which is Glenn Doreen. He is the electronics editor at Consumer Reports, and he's going to talk to us about the top 10 electronic gifts for this year. And Larry, that ranges all the way from a $30 device that, truthfully, whoever you give it to is going to say, wow, thanks, I want one of these, to a $9,000 television, which who wouldn't want one of those? So that'll be an interesting discussion.
I think I'd rather have $9,000 in my pocket.
There's not many $30 gifts that make you say, wow, I really wanted one of those. So stay tuned to hear what that is. And then our final guest is going to be Vanessa De Palma Wright. She is the owner of Farasha Boutique. And this is actually really clever. They've done pop-up stores that are open for maybe a month or 2 months all throughout the country. They've most recently been in Sun Valley, and they've decided to make a permanent home for their boutique of designer clothes and other accessories right here in Park City on Main Street. So that's going to be exciting. This is Mountain Money. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau provides your business with lots of benefits, from business-to-business networking and promotional opportunities to access to our 1,000-plus membership database. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Okay, welcome back to Mountain Money, and we have on the line with us now Matthew Hart. And Matthew is the author of Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal. This is his seventh book. One of his previous ones is Diamond. So you can kind of see a theme here of taking something of great value and finding out everything there is to find out about it. He's written for the Atlantic Monthly, the London Times, the Financial Post. He's been on 60 Minutes and CNN and the National Geographic Channel, and coming to us from New York. Welcome, Matthew.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
You bet. Well, tell us about everything you know about gold in the next 20 minutes. I guess it's enough to fill a book since you did. What makes gold and not something like, I don't know,
Bitcoins?
Coal or Bitcoins or platinum or something else? What makes gold the gold standard of the world anyway?
That's a question. That's a very, very good question. It's a question that people have been scratching their heads about for a long time. And the short answer is we value gold because we always have. But how long is always have? That was a relatively recently answered question and answered by accident. In 1972, a backhoe operator in a town on the Black Sea called Varna, it's in Bulgaria, was digging a foundation for an apartment building, and accidentally he unearthed a Neolithic tomb. So they called in the archaeologists, they opened it up, and inside they found this treasure of tiny gold ornaments, beautiful tiny little things, and they were 6,000 years old. Beautiful little miniature breastplates, figures of antelopes with delicately curled horns and little pieces that looked like a piece of DNA made out of gold. Just absolutely beautiful. 6,000 years old, so Neolithic people were wearing gold jewelry. And I guess that's as far back as we can go. And obviously people were mining it before then. And all you can do as to why they valued it and treasured it is speculate, since they were pre-literate people. We don't have a record of what they thought. But you can guess, and I think you can make a pretty good guess, that somebody spots this absolutely beautiful object in like a stream, and it's glittering, and it's pretty, and it's bright in a very dull and harsh world. Not only that, it's malleable. It's really, really soft compared to what they're used to, the flint and iron and stuff. It's soft, and it can be made into beautiful images. So they treasured it.
Hey, Matthew.
And then that's the kind of the foundation for our love affair, I think.
Great. And let's go forward to today, or really since the industrial age. Many countries 100 years ago were on what was known as the gold standard, including the U.S., and we're no longer there. But I, you know, this is a show about business and finance, and I think the story of gold and the gold standard is actually a really interesting one. First, explain to our listeners what the gold standard is and why it was important in not just U.S. history, but the world's history.
Oh, well, the gold standard, the gold money was invented in 635 B.C., and until 1971, when the U.S. killed the gold standard, gold was the absolute spine of the world financial and monetary system. And the gold standard was simply a way that governments brought order to the issue of paper currency, because you can't be lugging around, you know, tons of gold to buy things. You can't be lugging gold coins here and there from country to country to pay for things, because it's cumbersome and you can get robbed. So people very quickly developed paper money to stand for gold. So that was private money, because banks issued it. Then when governments themselves started issuing paper money, eventually the gold standard developed. And what the gold standard is you can only issue currency that is backed up by your gold reserves. So in other words, if you have X gold reserves and the price agreed between countries is Y, that determines how much currency you have. And you can't just issue currency unless you have more gold. So scrolling ahead to our current crisis, when the banking crisis that followed the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008, the Fed would not have been able to do quantitative easing. It would not have been able to inject money into the economy by the bond purchase program that involves the government essentially printing money to buy its own debt.
And you know, the irony is half of our audience out there is thinking, that would have been a good thing. We never should have been printing money. And the other half of our audience is saying, boy, thank goodness we weren't on the gold standard then.
And I see both points of view. I mean, the gold standard is a way to discipline the government. And if you think it's a good thing that the government should have its hands tied in the matter of issuing currency, should be absolutely shackled to this, then you think the gold standard is a great thing.
Hasn't it?
But
if
you think the government should have monetary flexibility, then you think the gold standard is a bad thing.
Hasn't it always been a view of confidence that, and really truly though, a fallacy that the U.S. or any sovereign nation had enough gold to back up all their currency? That's actually never really been the case. Is that correct?
You know, that's a hard question to answer, but after World War II, the United States had 20,000 tons of gold bullion. They had almost 75% of the world's supply of all monetary gold. So the system that developed was the U.S. dollar was backed by gold, and the other currencies were then pegged to the U.S. dollar. So if you had lots of extra U.S. dollars, as a lot of countries did, you could cash them in for gold. And then when the U.S. had a bad balance of payments and so many people were cashing them in that gold was hemorrhaging out of Fort Knox, that's when Nixon slammed the door and closed the gold window and said, that's it. From now on, you bring a dollar here to cash it in, we give you another piece of paper. But so how much is the currency backed up by it? Well, if you take the United States reserve, presently at 8,000 tons of gold, and you work out how much currency it backs up, say the currency supply is probably about $1 trillion. If you value it at the value that the Fed, that the Treasury carries it on its books, which is $42 an ounce, then it only backs up a tiny fraction of the currency. But if you value the United States gold hoard at the current gold price, it backs up about a third of the currency. So that's just one way of looking, because in fact, statutorily, the United States gold reserve is committed to backing up the currency. There's a chain of statutes that establishes that through gold reserves, gold certificates issued to the Fed by the Treasury. So, you know, actually, a lot of the United States money supply is backed up by gold.
Now, why has gold become kind of the last refuge in bad times? Everybody hurries to gold, because isn't it a fact that as we get more sophisticated in exploring and being able to extract gold, we're finding gold everywhere on Earth, aren't we? We're finding a bunch of it just 4 hours west of Interstate 80 where we sit. Is the Carlin Trend in Nevada, and they're just scooping it out of the ground. Although it's microscopic, they're still scooping a lot out.
Well, the Carlin Trend is, of course, one of the greatest treasure houses on the face of the earth. It's very, very rich. Those are million-ounce mines. But, I mean, there are big new consumers today as well as new producers. Let's take China, which I describe in detail in my book. China's the biggest gold producer in the world today. Now, it got to be the biggest gold producer, not by having a single large mine, because they don't. They don't have one big gold mine, nothing that would even compare to the Carlin Trend. They have tens of thousands of small mines. So they are sucking up every flake of gold in that country. And it's a very efficient machine for extracting gold. So they're the biggest gold producer, and also, far and away, the world's biggest gold consumer now. So now their resources are running down pretty quick. Their reserves, as estimated by the U.S. Geological Survey, very small, probably only enough at the current rate of extraction to last about 4 years or something like that. So if China maintains its appetite for resources, and I don't see why it wouldn't, and they run out of gold, then there's going to be a huge demand. And it all depends, like, the amount of gold in the world, whether there's, you know, X or Y or enough to last, totally depends on price. Nothing else determines whether there is a mineable deposit, because a gold deposit, gold ore, is not created by the creator. It's created by math. If it's worthless ground at one price, it might be a valuable gold deposit at another price. So whether there's enough gold to continue satisfying demand depends entirely on the gold price.
That's an interesting point. You know, I work in the financial world, and I occasionally get asked by my clients, you know, they're just curious about different financial aspects. And occasionally I'll be asked, how did the U.S. end up being the world's currency? Because that's a really important piece for the U.S. You think about it, essentially, it is interest-free loans for the U.S. government. When China, you mentioned China earlier, holds probably $500 billion in U.S. currency as reserve, right? And we're not paying them any interest on that. That's just sitting in some bank somewhere. So that's a very valuable thing for any country to have. And fortunately for us, it's the U.S. currency. And, you know, I knew a little bit about the story, but your book, surprisingly to me, touched on how the U.S. became the U.S. currency, which has to do with the Bretton Woods Accord after World War II. And I think there's folks in our audience that would be curious, how did the U.S. end up being the world's currency, and how did World War II and the Bretton Woods Accord play into that?
Well, I'll tell you, but first of all, you're absolutely right that the United States has huge advantages by having its dollar as the world currency, because, for instance, all commodities are priced in dollars. Gold is priced in dollars. Oil is priced in dollars. So that means the U.S. buying these, a U.S. buyer of these commodities, has no transaction cost. You don't have to buy euros from anybody. You don't have to buy British pounds from anybody. They have to buy your dollars to complete the purchase. That's how that works. Now, after the war, but for the first few years of the war, the United States wasn't even at war. So it was this huge industrial behemoth supplying countries that were at war and, of course, charging for that. Not only that, but before war even came, there was a huge flood of gold and other assets into the United States for safekeeping from Europe, countries that were afraid of war. So after the war, the United States, untouched by war itself, I mean, its cities totally intact, its industrial infrastructure humming along, this titanic nation with 75% of all the monetary gold in the world, well, whose currency were you going to use? There was no question of other countries being on the gold standard because they didn't have any gold. They had no gold at all.
In fact, the U.S.
had all the gold.
The U.S. pushed for that, right? We didn't want to trade with people that weren't on the gold standard because it was to our advantage. We had all the gold.
You had all the gold, exactly.
Right.
So you said, we'll back up our dollar with gold, and you back up yours. You peg your currencies to our dollar.
So we'll that's, work out that
how,
to me is
how
the fascinating.
The yen is worth. So that's how it became the world's reserve currency. And then in 1971, when the deal didn't look so good for the U.S. anymore, because too many people were cashing in their dollars for the simple reason that Americans were buying foreign goods and foreigners weren't buying American goods, and money was flowing out, bullion was hemorrhaging out of the United States. Nixon just said, that's the end of that. Well, you know, because I describe in my book the famous meeting and the crisis that led up to it. And the United States basically, well, you know, stiffed the rest of the world, said, that money you have now, that's it.
It's paper.
Well,
yeah.
If you have all that, you're not going to go around talking down the U.S. dollar if that's your main reserve.
So, you know, I where you were going with this, I thought was fascinating too, right? End of World War II, the U.S. has all the gold. We pushed the whole world to go on a gold standard. 1971, we don't have so much of the gold. And the Nixon shock comes where Nixon tells the world the U.S. is no longer going to be on the gold standard. Tell us how that came to be. Tell us the story of the Nixon shock.
Well, the Nixon shock is basically because the United States didn't like the way things were going. After the war, here's what the U.S. thought. We'll help these countries make loans, and then when their economies recover, they will buy American goods. They'll come in and buy our cars and all the great things that we make in America. Well, that worked for a while. Then their economies did recover, and they started making some pretty nice stuff. And then Americans decided, you know what? We like German cars, and we like Japanese electronics. So you take U.S. dollars and buy the foreign car or the Japanese electronics. Eventually, the Japanese banks end up with huge amounts of U.S. dollars. Since Japanese people are not in turn buying an equal amount of stuff from the state, the banks have nowhere to use those dollars, so they take them back to the states to cash in for gold. That's what happened. Finally, from 20,000 tons reserve, you end up with 8,000 tons. And it was a headline story and a crisis and a great an anguish for Nixon. And they plotted out what to do. They would tell the story that the United States was not going to let foreign speculators push it around anymore. Well, of course, that wasn't the story. But that's the story they told, and they got away with it. It took the world off the gold standard.
So let's talk a little bit about now a lot of people want to invest in gold. They feel better having gold. So are people moving physical gold all over the world, or are they moving paper that represents gold? I see in the markets you can buy gold futures, like you could buy corn futures for gold not yet mined, and yet other people want Krugerrands or some other country's little round gold coins. So how are all those who speculate in gold dealing with gold? Are there big shipments of gold always moving around the world?
Well, first of all, you can buy gold as easily as you can order a pizza, practically. I mean, there are dealers who will deliver gold coins to your door. So you call up and you say, yeah, I want this much, and you give them your credit card, and bang, around comes the gold. But most of the gold trade, of course, does not move gold around because it's too cumbersome. It stays in vaults. It generally in London. The biggest bullion market in the world is the London Bullion Market. It trades $20 trillion worth of gold a year. That's $33 billion worth of bullion traded in London alone every single business day. And if you want to look at that another way, as much gold changes hands in London in a three-month period as has been mined in all of history. So it's a huge trade, and it doesn't involve bullion going around. Most people own gold, including very, very large speculators like John Paulson, in the form of shares in gold bullion funds, like the ETF that gold traders call the SPDR, SPDR gold shares. You can look it up. And the SPDR was invented in 2004, basically by gold miners, because their production was increasing so much. They wanted to make an easier product for Americans who had for many years been forbidden by law from buying gold, but now are allowed to. They wanted to give them an easier way to buy gold. They surveyed investors and said, would you own gold, and why don't you? And investors said, yeah, I'd have that as part of my portfolio, and the reason I don't is it's too cumbersome. I have vault storage costs. I have to pay commissions to the people I buy it from, bullion banks. It's too awkward, so I don't do it.
Now,
so
John Paulson,
gold. You can buy it as easy as buying a share of General Motors.
Yeah, you know, John Paulson, who you mentioned earlier as a speculator or investor in gold, struggled with that as well. And I think where he ended up is he actually cut a deal with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York to actually hold some of the physical gold that he's invested in. So he has some of it outside a certificate, which brings me to my question, Matthew. We have time for one last question. And you have so many fascinating stories in your book. And I was trying to decide which of the two to ask. One was, I think most our listeners, most Americans, would be shocked to know there was a short period of time where it was against the law to own gold in the United States. FDR actually passed this. I occasionally tell that as a story to clients, just as something interesting to talk about. The other thing I think would be interesting for you to share and is going to get be my question, which circles back to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I think most listeners would be surprised to see where most gold, the biggest gold vault in the United States is. It's not Fort Knox, and you've been there, Matthew, so I was hoping you could tell our audience where that is and what that facility is like.
Yeah, I have been there, and what's more, any one of your audience can go there. Anyone can visit it. Go online to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and it's down on Maiden Lane, Wall Street, basically. It's lower Manhattan. It's a couple of miles from where I am right now. And you can go online and book an appointment. You go in there. They give you a little tour of their gold museum, which is very, very interesting and well done. And besides, it's a beautiful building, very well maintained, really nice to be in. Then you get on this elevator and you go down five stories under lower Manhattan. And there's the vault. Of course, it's enormous. And what it has is these various sections, like cages, like a cell, as if the gold were a prisoner. And they move gold, and that's, you know, you're looking at, say, Mexico's hoard of gold, and then over there will be part of the German gold and maybe some other Italian gold or something, whoever holds, you know, reserve. Many countries have their gold held there by the Federal Reserve Bank, and they shift gold around to settle trade imbalances, just the way they used to under the gold standard.
Just like in the Harry Potter movie.
These workers at the Federal Reserve Bank have these trolleys, and they actually move the gold around in the vault as its ownership changes. So it's really worth a look.
I did not know that is open to the public. I for sure am going to go, and I think listeners, if you happen to be in New York City, I'm imagining they don't charge for that tour. That sounds like a fun, free 1 hour in New York City.
Yeah, you bet it is. They don't charge for it, and there were a lot of foreign tourists on it when I went down.
Interesting stuff. Interesting subject, and it'll be with us for the next many thousands of years, I'm sure. Matthew Hart, author of Gold, The Race for the World's Most Seductive Metal, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Now, coming up after the weather, we'll be talking about gadgets, Doug. That sounds fun.
We will. You heard my excitement at the intro, and I'm really looking forward to this. Our next guest is going to be Glenn Doreen. He's the electronics editor of Consumer Reports, and he's going to talk to us about the top 10 top electronics. So I'm looking forward to that. Stay tuned.
And we have some great news on the weather front, which is that this is the last day in single digits, allegedly. And tomorrow, after a -4 predicted tonight, we're going to...
Which sounds frigid. Adjective number two.
And we don't talk about a wind chill around here either. That just makes it more ridiculous. But tomorrow, we're expecting a high of 20. And on Wednesday, a high of 28 with patchy fog. So conditions are going to change, and no one is going to be sorry to see them change. So we will be back to talk electronic gadgets after this.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Just because it's white outside doesn't mean you can't stay green.
Listen to This Green Earth every Tuesday at 9 a.m.
Discussing environmental issues from methane gas to moose habitat.
Air quality to fire ecology.
And bark beetles to eating bugs.
That's This Green Earth, brought to you by Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
And Rocky Mountain Power.
Underwriting on KPCW is supported by Mountain West Bank in Park City, a community bank offering home financing service and guidance. Mountain West Bank is located near Kearns Boulevard next to the movie theater. More information at mountainwestbank.com. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest is going to be Glenn Doreen, and we're going to talk electronic gifts. But before we do, Larry, we just received this week a reminder from the IRS to remind our listeners and folks that are running small businesses here in Park City or larger businesses about the benefits of hiring qualified vets returning from service. Turns out, unfortunately, their unemployment rate is really quite high. And the IRS offers, or the U.S. government offers, a tax credit of up to $9,600 per worker. It depends on the type of job and various factors. But up to $9,600 per worker when you hire a vet, which is a great thing to do. And the deadline is fast approaching. You have to hire the qualified vet before January 1st. So I guess December 31st would be the last hire date.
Yeah, so get moving.
You know,
good idea always to hire vets anyway. I mean,
it's surprising to me that the unemployment rate is so high for vets.
It would seem to me if you can report for duty and be in uniform and just have that military discipline that it automatically makes you a better employee than the average.
Well, you're focused and dedicated, and not only that, but you know the job in the military today is quite a bit different than you know during World War II.
Well, it's a lot of technology.
It's a lot of technology. It's a lot of training they go through.
Indeed, and you know, here's another story from this past week. If you're getting any benefits from the Department of Workforce Services, like unemployment and such, and you get them through the electronic payment card. J.P. Morgan administers that card, and they had a big data breach on Thursday. A data breach on the bank's servers affecting Utah DWS customers from July 17th to September 17th. Personal information was inappropriately accessed, and the DWS statement on that subject reads as follows. The Department of Workforce Services is committed to protecting Utah's personal information and will work closely with J.P. Morgan to do everything possible to protect the security of our customers. It's frustrating that such a breach occurred on J.P. Morgan's servers, and we're carefully reviewing our relationship with the bank. So,
no place is safe from hackers. You know, when a firm like J.P. Morgan running a government program can get hacked, You know, Larry, I think our third guest is in studio. Maybe we switch, and while we're making that transition, you know, I occasionally get asked in my business, should I own gold? So just wrapping up from our conversation with Matthew. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with owning gold, but the thing I tell folks is it's probably an investment that you have in your portfolio for a long period of time. It's not something you want to trade, because what information are you going to use to say, well, gold at today's price is cheaper high? But if you want to have 3 or 5% in your portfolio and hold it for 10 years, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But to try to trade it, I think most people are going to find they lose money.
Yeah, and yet it's kind of, as we said, the last refuge of investors.
Well, we're going to jump to our third guest this morning, Glenn Doreen, who's our Consumer Reports interview. We haven't been able to get a hold of him yet, so he's going to be our final guest. And Vanessa DePalma Wright, who's the owner of Ferocia Boutique, is here in studio with us. Vanessa, welcome to Mound Money. You are looking stunningly beautiful this morning.
Thank you. That's a nice welcome.
As somebody that's opening a clothing boutique here in Park City should look. So I gave a little bit of a preview at the top of the hour about the concept of your store, which has really been pop-up stores throughout the nation. Tell us why you decided on Park City for your first full-time staying store.
Well, actually, Ferocia Boutique was established in 2009 at the turn of the recession. As you know, at that time, a lot of small boutiques were going out of business. And I decided to come up with a concept that was basically a low-risk business model. I recently did a course at Oxford and wrote my thesis on pop-up boutiques, so I'm kind of a pop-up nerd. But as I said, it was a low-risk business opportunity. I've always wanted to be in the fashion industry. I was actually in communications, Latino marketing for 6 years, and I thought I would give it a try. And the great thing about pop-up boutiques is that you can travel around and test markets. If you look into it, everybody's doing pop-up boutiques, from Apple to Walmart to
Intel.
Prada.
Intel's doing it.
And so what was great about it, even during a recession, is that you are essentially creating this hype, and at the same time, people know that you're only there for 10 days to a month, and so consumers still purchase because they know that it's a short-term thing. And so once you pick up and move, it's not a matter of, oh, I can go back next week, there'll be a sale, there'll be new inventory. It's kind of a now kind of purchase. So that's kind of how we've established it. And the concept basically revolves around representing emerging designers from around the world. I actually travel a lot. And every time I travel, I either meet with a showroom or a designer that I could represent. I just got back from India. We picked up some designers from Delhi, also Nepal, in Argentina. And it's really an opportunity to give these emerging designers who are not represented in department stores, who are not mass producing their products, to have the opportunity to come into niche markets like Park City or Sun Valley, or we were just in Santa Monica this summer, and to promote their brands and to actually sell it to a direct consumer.
So how are you finding these designers? Do they have shops of their own and you're just walking down streets and popping in?
Some of them do. You'd be surprised. Now that we've been in business for about 4 years, designers kind of have their own networks and they talk. You know, I have designers in Chicago that I work with, and they go to markets and different things that they do. And so they're communicating. We work with, you know, we talk a lot with Project Runway. And, you know, as you know, emerging designers are kind of a hot thing right now in the fashion industry. People are looking for something different, especially people who are affluent, who have disposable income. They don't want to walk into a party and have the same piece of jewelry or the same outfit. And so we're kind of catering to that niche market. We are more high end. I mean, our average price points, I would say, are $250 to $500. But we look for unique, different things that will communicate with that specific market.
I know, so it's a problem with Doug and I worrying about showing up.
I can tell. I can tell. You guys are trouble.
With the same sweater at a party.
So talk to us about, you were talking about designers, and you talked to them about having a chance to showcase it. And I'm sure part of that is showcase their work in Park City. And I'm curious as to the value of the brand of Park City, because I think it's important for this town to remember the value of this brand. So as you talk to designers about the brand Park City, what is their reaction?
Well, I'll be totally honest with you about that. When I started Frasha Boutique, the first thing I would say is I want to start a pop-up boutique that's going to represent your brand in a high-end market in Park City, Utah. They would kind of pause, and then I would say, it's the home of the Sundance Film Festival, and they would say, when do you want me to ship you the box?
Wow.
So I think Sundance Film Festival actually helped me grow
my
business.
Not the Olympics, Sundance Film Festival.
No, I mean, I think the Olympics, you say the Olympics and people forgot about that. Huh. I mean, I grew up in New York City. You know, when I moved to Utah 15 years ago, I used to joke around with my mom. I would say, just buy something and send it, you know, because our shopping was kind of dry and it was boring. But we've evolved over the years. And I think that, you know, I've lived here for 15 years and I realize the value not only of the quality of life, but Park City is an international place with people from all over the world, and we are very savvy in our fashion, in our food, and the things that we like. This is a resort town, and so I think that that works for us and that we are serving that niche. And now over the years, what I've realized is, you know, when I first opened my business, the first thing I wanted to do was do a pop-up in New York City because that's where I grew up, and I felt like that was kind of the hub of fashion. And, you know, as you grow your business, you learn from trial and error, obviously. And New York City was probably the worst pop-up I've ever had. The competition is fierce.
Yeah.
There's 25 boutiques. There's a million things to do. It's just, it's tough. And what I've learned through the years is that niche markets like Sun Valley, like Park City, Vail is what we're looking at for 2014. Those are the markets where we're actually going to thrive and people are going to appreciate the concept.
Yeah, you have an offering that's very different than probably most towns have.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let me ask. Go ahead, Larry. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to ask. So if you go into Frasha, will one designer have 20 of the same handbag or is everything unique?
No, absolutely not. If it's apparel, we try to have a size run of that piece so that you come in, we can obviously have your size available. When it comes to accessories and handbags and jewelry, they are mostly one of a kind. A lot of times I'll get clients who will come in and actually request it in a different color and a different size for like a ring or a necklace, and the designers will say that's the only piece. It's one of a kind. And I actually like to operate that way because once it goes, then we try to obviously find something else that's new and hip and different.
So let me ask you this gorgeous hat you're wearing. So I'm looking, Linda, my wife's Linda, if you're listening to the radio, turn down the radio. I am struggling for a gift for my wife. So do you have that hat at your studio?
I'm going to be totally honest with you. I don't have this hat.
Oh.
This is vintage.
Larry, I was going to say, I don't even want to know how much it costs. I'm going to give you my credit card, cover it up, I'll sign it, and
sorry,
I'll wrap it
up. Sorry,
it's
not that easy, Doug.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But we do, like, for example, this cashmere sweater that I'm wearing is a new collection that we're, I actually was in Nepal in Kathmandu, and my travel guide said, what do you do? And so I started explaining to him what I do, and he said, my brother-in-law has a little company that makes cashmere sweaters. And so before I left to the airport, we met and had a coffee, and he showed me his collection, and we're going to be carrying it. So it's kind of like the little stories like that that makes us...
So every vacation is a business write-off for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now,
that's why I keep telling my
husband.
She never takes a vacation. They're all work trips. They're all buying
trips.
Well,
I like to combine, you know, leisure.
And you've been, you know, some of your pop-ups have been in places we would expect. Stein's, the St. Regis, you mentioned the one in New York City and Santa Monica. But then I see... one of your pop-up popped up in Uruguay.
Well,
you're all over the place.
I'm from Uruguay.
So okay.
I was born in Uruguay.
That makes sense now.
And so when I started the company, one of the first things that I wanted to do was go find a designer that I could represent. And her name's Kuka, actually. She's from Montevideo, Uruguay. And we're actually known for our leathers and hand-woven sweaters. So we carry her collection there. We are looking to doing Uruguay in 2014. The challenge is that the best time to go to Uruguay to do a pop-up is because the seasons are switched. It's summertime there,
it
would be now. And so my challenge is I can't clone myself.
Busy time here.
Yeah, it's busy time here. So that's been the hardest part. But we're still trying to make that work so that I can get away to the beach and and work. So,
so before we wrap up, you started the interview with a statement that we don't hear very often here, which is you're working on your dissertation at Oxford.
Yes.
And studied this pop-up. So what was that like? So you studied at Oxford. You got your master's there?
It's like a mini MBA, actually. I graduated from the University of Utah with a degree in communications and PR. And then I had my own Latino marketing agency for 6 years. And I wanted to be in fashion. And so when I went back to school, I really wanted to kind of focus my thesis and dissertation on something that was relevant to what I do. Right. Obviously, if you're going to spend all that time writing it, you might as well use it afterwards. So I went back to school in 2010. My husband and I went to Oxford and traveled back and forth for a year. And it was a great experience. And I actually learned a lot and applied a lot of the things that I applied to the dissertation to my business. So
that is phenomenal. So Utah is glad to have you here. Park City is glad to have your new store. Our guest is Vanessa DePelmo-Wright. She is the owner of Farasha Boutique, which is on Main Street, I believe.
605 Main Street. We're in the Park Hotel, which is the same building as Bangkok Thai. You just come up the stairs instead of down.
I'm going to see if I can't find a hard-to-find gift for my wife. I'll be visiting you in the next week.
Glad
Vanessa, thanks
out.
For coming in this
Thank
morning.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Same to you.
And we're going to wrap up with Glenn Doreen, electronics editor of Consumer Reports, about top 10 gadgets for gift giving this year, and we'll be back with him after this.
Park City Realty Group is proud to support KPCW. Park City Realty Group has provided real estate services to buyers and sellers since 2005. Our team shares local knowledge and insight with clients who value the Park City lifestyle. Knowledge plus hard work equals success. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Vanessa, it was a lot of fun to talk to. That was a fascinating conversation. And now, Larry, for something that you and I probably know a little bit more about than designer clothing.
A little bit more than, Nepal-made cashmere.
Our guest is Glenn Doreen, and he's the electronics editor at Consumer Reports, and we're going to talk gadgets, some affordable gadgets and some more expensive. Welcome to Mountain Money, Glenn.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you taking the time.
So top 10 electronics, boy, there's just so many out there. Let's start off with maybe one or two of your favorites. We've got the list, and Larry and I will toss out a few more after that.
Sure.
So,
I wasn't sure if you wanted to bring them up or should I?
No. If you want to start off with a couple of your favorites, why don't you
start with phones? Because right here in this room, we have a Doug on a iPhone and me on a Droid, and we have constant discussions of who has the superior computer in our pocket.
Well, so you know, we actually think that there are that there are great phone choices for both platforms, and in our top 10 gadgets guide, we list both the new iPhone 5S as well as the LG G2 as really high performing devices. And the iPhone 5S has the new iOS 7. Although you can actually update your old iPhones to get that as well, but it also has this fascinating little fingerprint scanner built into the home key, which we found in our tests is actually quite useful. It's not just a gimmick. And then the G2 has this spectacular screen. It's a nice larger screen. We found that people who like larger screens probably tend to enjoy the Android platform because there's a little more variety there. And they also have done this innovative idea where they put the volume buttons on the back, because the bigger the screen gets, the harder it is to wrap your full hand around it. So it's an interesting bit of innovation there.
And do both or do all carriers carry one phone or the other?
The majors do, yes. So you should have no trouble getting the iPhone because all the majors have now made it a point to carry that. And the G2 is available, I believe, on all the carriers now. I think it launched on a few, but I think it's available on all of them now.
And you have to be careful too when you look at phones, because you've got the price in there, $100 to $200. That's the subsubsidized cost. If I wanted to buy Larry an iPhone. I would either be committing I'd either be committing you, Larry, to another 2-year contract at your carrier, or my price would probably be closer to $600 unsubsidized for that.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, it's you know, we have a whole every year we dig into cell phones in our January issue, and we found that that people are often surprised by the cost of their phone, the true cost of their phone, and you know, heaven forbid you actually break the thing in the middle of your contract.
And yeah, you got to pay full retail for your replacement one. You know, my favorite gift on your or technology gadget on your list, I guess it's really not a gift buying guide.
You can buy gifts for yourself too.
Absolutely. But you know, what do you buy somebody for? I put in the teaser $30. What do you buy somebody? It turns out it's $35. I was wrong. For $35 that they're going to say, wow, this is cool. Thanks. And it turns out there is a device on your list that is $35 that I think most people would say, this is cool.
Yeah, what you're referring to is the Google Chromecast.
Exactly.
And this is an incredible bargain for people. For $35, essentially it plugs into the HDMI port of your TV. And if you don't already have a smart TV, this will turn pretty much any TV into a smart TV and allow you to push content from your laptop, from the internet, that you would otherwise look at on your laptop or your tablet directly to the TV. And that means that web video, first of all, you don't have to upgrade your TV to upgrade the functionality of it. And also, some of the video that you have just normally been sitting at your desk watching, now you can enjoy with the big, bright TV on your wall.
It's probably the best I'm a big fan. I've got an Apple TV. It's essentially an Apple TV for $35. It's probably the best $35 you can spend.
Yeah, and it just goes to show just how inexpensive the concept of smart TV is becoming. There are also Roku devices at around $50. The Apple TV is $100. These things are not big ticket buys the way that a new TV would be, and that's why we're attracted to this concept.
So speaking of big ticket buys, you've seen the wow, the cool factor in two TVs in particular, but these are rather pricey items. The other extreme from the Google Chromecast.
Yeah, in fact, one of them is almost, we acknowledge it's relatively unaffordable for most people, but we wanted to sort of let people know just how good TVs can get. So there's a Samsung OLED TV. It's actually this curved, beautiful screen and OLED is a new product category that's just been emerging in the past couple of years. And what's great about it is that it is actually, it's somewhere between the technology that you'd see in plasma and LCD, and it sort of encompasses the best of both. It's super bright, it's got incredible contrast, and just has this stunningly vivid picture that's one of the best we've ever seen on a TV. And then similarly, there's the Sony Bravia XBR 55. I'm not going to go through the whole model name, but it's essentially Sony's newest ultra high definition TV. And ultra high definition is another emerging product category in TVs, and it's essentially beyond high def right now. It's the next generation of high def, and now it's worth caveating to say that there's not a lot of content out there like this. But when you do see a 4K image, it's also known as Ultra HD image on one of these TVs, it's truly mind-blowing. It's like seeing, a 35-millimeter photo in front of your face in video.
Yeah, now the whole trouble with being an early adapter and buying the Samsung OLED for $9,000 or the Sony Bravia for $4,000 is very quickly, generally, the price drops, or very quickly, a new one's even better. Is that the case here? Should you run from these and just wait 6 months for another version?
So you're absolutely right that the price drop tends to be pretty can make people who spent that money early on feel a little foolish. And certainly with Ultra HD this coming year, you're going to see the prices drop. In fact, there are already a couple of sets, not ones that we'd recommend, but there are already a couple of sets on the market below $1,000 for Ultra HD. So that points to where the market as a whole is going to go. So I'm not sure I would really recommend people buying into Ultra HD now. OLED's probably going to take a little longer because just it's harder to manufacture. But they're obviously pointing towards where the technology is going. And whether or not you buy this type of stuff or want to spend that type of money these days, it's worth knowing this should be on your radar for the future.
And the challenge, Larry, with staying on the sidelines is, you, believe it or not, you end up like me. I like small gadgets, but larger gadgets I'm slow to adopt. And before I knew it, I had a 25-year-old television that literally, when I bought this Apple TV that I was so hype on, yeah, I couldn't connect it to my television. It was so old. So at that point, I had to upgrade. So, but I'd always been waiting. Well, in 6 months, there'll be a better model. In 6 months, it'll be half the price. But 25 years later, I still have the same TV.
If you still have a TV that takes two grown men to lift and is and is 3 feet deep on your shelf, you're living in a different world.
Now this TV still worked. I had to actually pay somebody $50 to take that TV out of my house.
Well, somewhere between that and this stuff is the is what's worth buying right now.
Is the sweet spot.
Good advice.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, you have a couple of cameras you're in love with too. One for its size and one for its great zoom lens.
That's true. The Canon EOS Rebel SL1. That's the one you're referring to in terms of its size. It's strange. It's not the smallest camera on the market, but it's one of the smallest SLR cameras out there right now. And it's worth noting just how large SLRs typically have been. You know, when you look at certainly the professional models, they're large, cumbersome things that can, you know, drag you down by your neck if you hang them there.
Not the great thing to have on the Grand European Tour. No.
No. But the photographs they take are so incredibly good because they have these dedicated lenses on them. You can swap lenses out. They have far better controls than any other type of camera. So what the new Rebel does is really sort of shrink the form factor to allow the best of an SLR with that viewfinder where you can view the picture through the lens. So all the best features of an SLR, just in a nice compact frame that doesn't feel really sort of cumbersome to carry around. And then the other camera that we have on our list, the Sony CyberShot Super Zoom camera, has a incredible 30x optical zoom lens, and that goes down to a very wide angle. So it's just incredibly flexible. You can take pictures of things that are very far away and also get those wonderful interior shots that you need a wide-angle lens for as well. And it's just an inch and a half thick, too, so it just slides right into a pocket.
Well, I think we've covered everything except your favorite tablet, and it doesn't come from Apple.
Yeah, so it's not that we don't like Apple tablets. It's just that the Kindle Fire HDX is a relative bargain at $230, and it also has a lot of interesting, innovative features. It's really slim, very lightweight.
Actually, we're looking at one right here in the studio that our producer Beth has.
See, and apparently it appeals to people so much that your producer's already went out and gotten one, right?
Actually, yep. Full disclosure, that's an iPad mini, but it is the Kindle the Kindle product. It's unbelievable they can make that for under $250. They can sell it for under $250.
Yeah, and that Amazon has a history of doing that. They basically make most of their money on the content, so they're willing to sell the actual devices at a, you know, super razor slim margin. But the best thing about it is something called the Mayday button, which Amazon really pioneered. And it's you tap a section on the screen, and you can talk to a real person within seconds, and that's pretty incredible. Tech support from a real human being. Tell me what type of electronics company offers that these days.
Well, very good. That is fascinating. I've been looking forward to this all week. Larry told me you were going to be our guest this week, and I thank you for joining us this morning. Our guest is Glenn Doreen, the electronics editor at Consumer Reports. Always fun talking tech gadgets. Larry, we're going to have to do this again.
And we'll be back.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
I want to thank our great sponsors, Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, and San Francisco Design. And our thanks to our guests, Matt Hart, who wrote the Gold Book, Glenn Doreen, and Vanessa De Palma Wright. And don't forget to join Chris and Nell with This Green Earth tomorrow. They'll be talking with Rocky Mountain Power and Habitat for Humanity about Watt Smart Technology. This is KPCW Park City.